gentlemen. And we are going to open an informational meeting this afternoon to continue our attempt to find out where land use is in Oregon at this point without particularly going into Measure 37, which should be refreshing to some of us. So I'd like to ask to come forward Bob Stacey, the Executive Director of Thousand Friends of Oregon. And Bob, if you'd like to bring your new employee with you and introduce him to the committee, that would be appreciated.
Sure. Hold on there. Phone number here, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Bob Stacey, 1,000 Friends of Oregon Executive Director, and with me is Elon Hassan, who, as of Thursday of last week, is our staff lobbyist. And Elon is young, smart, energetic, and knows something about the legislative process, but is eager to learn from the people who serve. And we're looking forward to having an opportunity to work with you.
Welcome aboard, Leo.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the courtesy of inviting 1,000 Friends of Oregon to participate in this briefing session. As I told the chair, my remarks are likely to be a little more free-form and unstructured, and are frankly an invitation for your guidance about what questions you would like us to address. But I gave to the clerk copies of three documents that can be found on our website that we distribute to citizens in response to requests for information about the land use planning program that address what we believe are some common questions about land use planning in Oregon. You might notice that there's a logo from 1,000 Friends of Oregon in the upper left-hand corner. That signals that these are our opinions, not those of LCDC or necessarily other interest groups. But we're pretty serious about our view that land use planning in Oregon is a success. It's a success economically. It's a success in terms of its contribution to the protection of important working resources and for its contribution to helping communities become stronger economically and socially as they become places with more choices for housing, for how we get around in our communities, and accessibility to nature, as well as to business, employment, retail, and the like. So these papers address just three slices of our land use program. Regional differences, which is a recurring theme in the Legislative Assembly's discussion of land use planning. Why should we have a one-size-fits-all approach to Eastern Oregon or Western Oregon, to the Willamette Valley versus Greater Oregon, for the Portland metropolitan area and for Medford or for Fossil or for John Day? Is it fair or appropriate to have one set of rules for all the communities and all the counties that make up Oregon? And this very brief paper tries to point out that indeed there are differences recognized in the state statutes and in the LCDC goals that permit cities of different populations and growth rates, communities on both sides of the mountain, and agricultural areas with different soil capabilities, elevations, and other growing conditions to approach everything from minimum lot sizes to the required planning schedule to the detail required of cities in their planning programs. Farmland protection, obviously a recurring issue and concern, because the protection of agricultural land is both one of the principal objectives of Senate Bill 100 and Senate Bill 101 of 1973, as Senator McPherson described on Monday to the joint committees. But it is also the focal point of a great deal of tension about the balance between individual property considerations, property owner considerations, and the impact of development on sustained agricultural use of agricultural land. So there's a detailed discussion here of some issues that arise because the state statutes, the LCDC goals and rules, and county comprehensive plans contain both stringent provisions to try to limit the amount of non-farm development in farm zones, and a significant number of exceptions to that general rule, so that we know that now there are some 50 different non-farm uses that are permitted in the so-called exclusive farm use zone. Each one of those had a reason for its inclusion in statutes. Each one of those has been discussed back and forth in various sessions of the Assembly. So each of them has a history behind them. And each is an attempt to respond to a real world issue, to balance the objective of protecting the maximum amount of agricultural land for continued farming and ranching with the needs of rural communities, with the needs of property owners to have flexibility in the use of their land. Finally, Urban Growth Boundaries and Housing Costs, the final paper, tries to describe, responds to some of the questions that are asked about urban growth management in the state of Oregon. We're one of a handful of states that uses the urban growth boundary approach. There are many individual communities across the country where cities and counties working together to establish urban growth boundaries, or increasingly in California, where there's, as you know, high levels of growth, voters in counties have voted to impose urban growth boundaries through the initiative process. Our process is not governed by a law that goes in and locks an urban growth boundary in a single location, but by planning rules that allow a city and county working jointly to expand urban growth boundaries. And in fact, for some cities and counties, LCDC requires them to expand urban growth boundaries every 5 years unless they can demonstrate that they've accommodated growth needs through other means. Certainly, I'm not going to go through all these points, but for an effort to indicate that we have information that we provide to the public, I hope this information is useful to you as well, and I will be glad to answer questions about it. I did want to talk briefly about some of the benefits that we see from our planning program in Oregon. I've spoken briefly of economic development and agricultural land. I do want to emphasize that while agriculture is not, along with timber, the 1-2 industry that it was when Senate Bill 100 was adopted, it is in fact the number two industry in modern Oregon as well. Agriculture is a growing economic sector, not a declining one. A 4% growth rate in 2003 versus an absolute decline in the percentage of employment and output in the high-tech industry during that year, for example. A much slower growth rate than the volatile and robust growth that led to an explosion of high-tech development in Washington County in the 90s. But a sustained growth rate around the state in many different farm economies that has enabled the farm industry as a whole to post continued gains, even as one sector or one commodity line has slipped. We now have over $3 billion a year in gross farm gate production, and there's a multiplier effect to bring that number higher in terms of its overall impact on the state's economy. At the Port of Portland, I'm a Portland boy, so I tend to notice these parochial details. Agriculture is the number one industry in tonnage going across the port stocks and number two in total value of exports. So it's critically important to the economic development of the city of Portland, something that Portlanders may sometimes forget, but that continues even as it was in the last century, a direct connection between the economy of the state's largest city and the land of the state. Nursery stock, many people point to as the number one agricultural commodity. In fact, it's number two when we combine all cattle and hay, including dairy. Cattle and hay are the number one commodity in the state. But nursery stock is number two, and it's heavily concentrated in the Portland metropolitan area. That gets it close to shipment, both at the port and the railheads and trucking. And that's an important relationship, and it points to the importance of the urban growth boundary principle, that we be cautious and careful about expanding onto productive agricultural lands as we expand the Portland metro urban boundary. I mentioned livestock raising and associated cattle production and dairying. the largest component of agriculture. That means that agriculture as an industry has importance throughout the state. In central and eastern Oregon, in the Boardman area of Morrow County, where most of the Tillamook Dairy's milk products are now produced, and of course in Tillamook County, where the Tillamook Creamery Association has what it calls a no net loss of farmland policy, which it regularly visits with the county commission about, to try to prevent the loss of the base upon which the original members of that co-op depend. And of course, the rural land policies that protect our farm and forest lands also have the secondary effect of making a major contribution to protecting some of the landscape and sense of place that is characteristic of Oregon. That's not something to be taken lightly. We don't want to interfere with people's property rights simply to make things look pretty. But if it is part of a program that protects productive farm and forest land, that's an important side benefit. Oregon, particularly in the Portland metro area, but in other growing communities in southern Oregon, in the Medford-Ashland area, in the Bend-Redmond area, certain areas of the coast, certainly in Hood River, Oregon is attracting what some national commentators call the young creatives, people younger than me, people smarter than me, people who can live anywhere they want in the country and pursue high income, high return employment, or who start their own businesses. Because they can live anywhere they want in the country, we have to compete on a number of levels. And one of the ways that Oregon competes successfully is through what many call its livability. That is an economic factor that economists in Oregon like Ed Whitelaw measure and believe they can quantify. Whitelaw calls it the second paycheck effect. And it's important as a driver in our economy that our metropolitan areas and our fast-growing smaller communities are attracting a larger than average percentage of people who bring creative talent and some personal wealth with them and who come to Oregon and Oregon's communities because they want to, not because they're looking for a job. Another way of looking at this phenomenon is the ability to recruit employees. I was visiting with a group of commercial and industrial developers and brokers 2 weeks ago, and there was a little debate as I discussed Measure 37 with them among members about whether Measure 37 was a very good idea or maybe something that they should have second thoughts about. And one who was arguing for second thoughts pointed out that companies he'd worked with had observed, and he pointed to one anecdote, companies choosing between a city in Oregon and the Atlanta area. And they went through an analysis. They really liked the idea of going to Atlanta for a number of business reasons, and they ultimately picked Oregon because their highly paid workforce, their trained workforce, the people they wanted to bring to the new plant, would have had been paid $30,000 to $60,000 a year more to persuade them to go to Atlanta. Now, if we want to maintain that kind of competitive advantage, most light on Atlanta, but we're more attractive, more desirable as a place for people who can bring wealth to this community, bring employment to this community, and give us family wage jobs. When we're pursuing that kind of economic development, we don't want a land use planning program that gets in the way, any more than we want it to impinge unnecessarily on private property interests in the countryside. We don't want it to interfere with or impede economic development in our towns and cities. The urban growth boundary process has to work effectively. It has to be able to respond to growth demands quickly if we're not to impose barriers to economic development. I think our track record there is pretty good. The best case, I'm going to have to use a Portland example, because Portland was the part of Oregon that grew, other than Bend and Redmond, which grew much higher by percentage. The North Willamette Valley, from Salem to up to the Columbia River, grew by 400,000+ people in the 1990s. The Portland metropolitan area vaulted up a couple of places in the ranking of national metropolitan areas. We had a phenomenal rate of growth. It was exceeded only by a few other places, such as the Las Vegas region. And Portland did that during the 90s without significant expansions of the urban growth boundary, and responded in the late 90s with expansions of 2,000 and then in 2,000 or 3,000 acres at the end of the decade, and then in 2002 another 18,000 acres to make sure that that rate of development and growth could be sustained. In the existing urban growth boundary, without significant expansion until the 98-99 time period, the Portland metro region and Salem, to a certain extent, accommodated 400,000 people, new jobs, new housing, and the price of housing went up. There's no denying the price of housing went up. But a comparative analysis that looks at the West Coast shows that Portland remains, for the size of metro area involved, the least expensive metropolitan area on the West Coast. You have to go inland to Las Vegas to find a less expensive location. And Las Vegas had a very high growth rate, and they spread across the desert dramatically, and they kept their housing prices lower. But the balance of the West Coast started with higher housing prices in Portland and ended with significantly higher housing prices in Portland. We stayed in the same place as everybody went up a housing cost escalator. Our urban growth boundaries didn't cause that, and we remained competitive on housing cost. The Mercer firm that recruits executive talent reports that Portland is something like 18 out of 21 major metro areas in terms of relative cost of living. Difficult for us to believe who live there, but compared to most other metropolitan areas in the country, it is more affordable, both in terms of housing and other costs. So we have a strategy that is protecting important working farms and forest land close to rapidly growing metropolitan areas that has demonstrated its ability to respond to rapid growth without forcing spikes in housing costs that are out of proportion to other metropolitan areas, and delivering economic development opportunities both in the countryside in terms of a continually expanding agricultural sector and in growing communities through the addition of land for jobs. It is not without its problems on both sides. Many in the agricultural community believe that 50-plus uses in the farm zone is a little much. Many believe that more land is protected than needs to be. But on balance, it's a program that gives Oregon a competitive advantage, and it's a program that we should try to retain and not see unhinged by application of the literal provisions of the measure just adopted by the people, as opposed to, if you will allow me this editorial, the goals behind the measure. I'm going to stop there. And
members of the committee, please feel free. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made a statement that you don't want to protect resources just to make things look pretty. And I think I can understand what you're saying, but does that apply to our forestry natural resources? Because I've heard a number of folks from the environmental community say that they really want to protect the cathedral forests and the beauty of our old growth. And I understand that. I'm certainly in favor of retaining some, but it seems to me that what you're saying isn't really correlated with the feeling among many folks on your side.
I hope there are folks on our side from a variety of perspectives. Yes. And
I think many of us cross the road in a lot of areas.
Right. I'm proud to be a conservationist myself and a supporter of economic development. 1,000 Friends of Oregon supports LCDC Goal 4, the forest lands goal, and its implementation in county plans. That goal says that forest use includes, in fact, the first use listed is commercial forestry, that is, the harvesting and replanting of commercial forest species on private land. There are a number of conservation organizations that have objectives to protect public lands from the same level of harvest activity that is pursued on private land, but the statewide planning goals apply to private land and apply to the protection of forest land for forest uses, including forest harvest operations and replanting and restocking under the forest practices rules. Absolutely.
kind of call?
Both.
Different issue. I happen to be very familiar with North Georgia and the Atlanta area because my oldest daughter moved there about 5 years ago, and just this last year my youngest daughter and her husband, they're all down there now. And North Georgia is just exploding.
Yeah.
And I think we need a better study than the anecdotal information you gave us on $30,000 more.
Touché.
My daughter moved from a two-bedroom, very small house, almost no land in Milwaukee, to a home, wasn't urban, but outside, of course, she had five bedrooms, double garage, a lot of land for $180,000.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of incentives there for the workforce that we may have to consider here. And I think, well, obviously the climate's different, but there's some beautiful land in North Georgia. I'm not moving there, but I think there are some other things that rise into that factor when a company makes the decision to move.
You might move and get enough grandkids down there. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we heard a lot of testimony, and we may hear some more yet, about our not treating land west of the mountains, about our tendency to treat agricultural land west of the mountains in the same way we treat agricultural land east of the mountains, the other way around, that there's not a lot of problem with the notion of protecting high-quality farmland in the Yamhill Valley that's selling for $50,000, $100,000 an acre or something. But when you get far east of the mountains, the value of the land basically depends on the extent to which you can get water onto it. And that there has been some criticism that our laws don't make sense in terms of the way we think about urbanization in eastern Oregon, especially excluding the Bend Redmond area. Could you comment on that a little bit? Can you help us some wisdom on that one?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chair Greenway, thanks. That is a large question, and it's an important question. First, I'm neither a farmer nor a rancher, so I can't give you that kind of expertise. But I'm not sleeping by the bell. I'll answer the question after the call.
Where we left off, it should be noted, however, that the fire alarm had to be some kind of response to Representative Greenwood's question.
Actually, I opposed the alarm to give him a chance to think about it.
So, Bob, consider that your hot seat has now cooled off a little bit, and if you'd like to continue your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question was, if I could restate it, Representative Greenlee, are there not differences between agriculture in Western Oregon, agriculture in Eastern Oregon, and shouldn't those differences be reflected in policy? I'd suggest first that they are along the lines that I opened with, that there are differences in the regulations that try to respect the differences in agriculture. But the underlying goal is the same in both cases. Agriculture of different kinds has different requirements of scale in order to be productive and viable. The scale for agriculture that is cropland, nursery stock, orchards will be different than the scale of land for grazing, for ranching. And those differences have to be reflected in the land use regulations, both in terms of what kinds of land is protected and at what level of partitioning and residential development. In both cases, the goal should be to protect the land upon which that agricultural industry depends and on which it's based. In the case of ranching, and you have far more qualified people here in today's, there are at least one among your invited witnesses who can talk about ranching in greater depth than I certainly can. Ranches are on a scale that is, in comparison to Western Oregon, enormous, 12,000, 15,000 or more acres. When you count the private land ownership and the federal allotments, you're talking about very large operations that depend upon being able to balance a number of cow-calf pairs with the right amount of acreage to sustain them, and the different kinds of acreage, lowland and highland, summer and winter grazing areas. And so they become very large operations. That makes them viable, but it also makes them vulnerable to interference from other kinds of land activities, both recreational, trespassing and lawful, rural residential development. The kinds of impacts that neighbors have on all agriculture can actually be out of proportion in their impact to rangeland and ranching. So there's an underlying question. What land does need to be protected for ranching, for orchards, for other kinds of agriculture? This is an area where ranchers and farmers should be at the table. If this committee, if this legislature looks at ways in which the land use planning laws might be amended as a response to Measure 37, and I would suggest you do that as a replacement for the waiver provisions of Measure 37, then you should seek the counsel of agriculture and ranching about what is the agricultural land base upon which those industries depend. The concern about urban land management, making sure that the urban development towns and neighborhoods are located inside urban growth boundaries, and that settlement outside of urban growth boundaries is low density enough that it doesn't put a strain on community services, that can be managed in other ways. If it's not agricultural land, if it's not forest land, if it's not rangeland, then you're looking at a different basis for policy than protecting the land base. You're looking at managing the impacts of rural development. And there are more tools, different parcel sizes, different regulations that can be employed. So a reasonable and rational starting point would be to say, are we protecting the right land? I would urge you to ask if you're protecting enough of it well enough, but there is a flip side to that question. Is some land being protected that doesn't need to be in order for ranching and other agricultural pursuits and industries to prosper? That's what I think the 30-year review will give the state an opportunity to explore in depth. But it may be a subject that you decide to address in this session as well.
Bob, I don't mean to paraphrase you on this, but I want to make sure I'm hearing what you're saying, is the Thousand Friends are open to the discussion of the fact that we have a problem in land designation and the land planning requirements between Eastern and Western Oregon.
Mr. Chairman, we must be open.
Be careful.
To all discussion about the land use planning laws, because we're Oregonians, because Oregonians have said something, none of us is quite sure the exact meaning of it, it has a very, very profound impact on our existing land use laws, and that if implemented as it is written, will have a devastating impact on some agricultural areas of the state. It's time to think about how to salvage our prime and high value and most productive agricultural land bases. And that means we must be open to exploring creative solutions. I'm not proposing a specific, but you know from your own county, Representative Garrard, that there are areas that Klamath County is mapped as non-resource. In recognition that those are not commercial forest land, and they're not grazing land of any character or quality. They're not the basis of either of those economies, and therefore they're designated something other than farm or forest. That principle may have other applications.
Yeah, we had a developer take on resource land and want to develop a subdivision on the side of a mountain that was non-resource. Only took him 8 years.
I don't know the facts of that situation. It doesn't sound like it was handled.
Be happy to fill you in with every
time. Yeah, I'll make it a
point. Any other questions? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, thank you for your presentation. And what I've been able to read over the past few years or several months about land use, I'm somewhat astounded about the lack of attention to anticipated population growth as it may affect land use planning. One statistics I found was that we will increase by 1 million people in the next 20 years. I find as I read your material you distributed here today, particularly page 2 of the yellow sheet, when you state that the growth rate in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties was 20%, and this was a lower rate of growth than other counties such as Jefferson, Crook, Deschutes, Umatilla, and Montier. I think that's apples and oranges, okay, because those counties that you're comparing it to are a much lower population base, therefore the percentages aren't entirely consistent with what you represent. I'm just kind of pointing that out because I will continue to make this point as a member of the committee that we're not paying enough attention to that. I also believe that we're probably in breach of the land use goal, which compels some form of affordable housing. And I don't know to what extent land use is contributing to that, but I think that I want to look at those issues more carefully and more closely, and I'd like your response on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ackerman, thank you. I would also refer you, Representative Ackerman, to the blue sheet, which tries to talk about the housing cost issue in the context of urban growth boundaries. There's some statistics there. And I'll acknowledge that these statistics are 1998, 99, 2000, and it's time for us to update these sheets. You're absolutely right about comparing percentages to absolute growth. The absolute growth in Washington, Clackamas, and to a lesser extent Multnomah County was astounding in comparison to other parts of the state. But on a proportional basis, and in the communities of Bend and Redmond and elsewhere in the state, their growth rates have been significant, and that's had a significant impact on what we need to plan for their urban growth boundaries. We hear during this legislative session from John Chandler of the State Home Builders and others specific concerns about the urban growth boundary process. It's been my experience that the urban growth boundary up at that end of the valley has been responsive, perhaps not on everyone's schedule, but has been responsive to the expansion in population and employment that's occurred in the Tri-County Portland metropolitan area. That area and the metro government are under a responsibility to review the boundary no less frequently than every 5 years, and to expand it unless they can demonstrate that they don't need to, because they've adopted other strategies for accommodating population and employment growth. There are other communities in the state that have that same requirement, but they're a handful. Most communities are left to themselves and to use the process of periodic review to expand their boundaries. LCDC has had under consideration administrative rule changes, the goal of which, according to the department, is to make it procedurally less complicated to respond to population growth and expand urban growth boundaries in anticipation of that growth.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For my information, relatively new to land use, I know that you, from your testimony the other day and then also today, feel that there are some major flaws with 37. Could you outline for me some of the major moves that Thousand Friends or other organizations like yours have made to make things easier so that we wouldn't get to 37?
We have attempted, Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, both last session and in 2001, to anticipate the probability that another measure, such as Measure 7, would be on the ballot. Because I was responsible for 1,000 Friends policy during 2003 as executive director, was not assertive enough or aggressive enough in efforts to anticipate that likelihood. In 2001, my predecessor did participate energetically in efforts to develop substitute legislation for Measure 7. And that was an undertaking that Representative Miller, then Representative Miller, and then Representative Schrader undertook. They spent a lot of person hours on that work. There were a lot of other actors, and Robert Liberty from 1,000 Friends of Oregon was, if you will, invited fairly late to those discussions, but was an active participant. And during those negotiations then, and subsequently, based on his conversations with me, was persuaded that legislation was desirable and that it was disappointing that it couldn't be accomplished in 2001. What we failed to do in 2003 was urge you to take action rather than, if you'll allow me this characterization, rather than allowing Oregonians in action to persuade you that their objective was changing the land use laws rather than compensation.
Okay.
We did oppose many changes to the land use laws last session. We viewed it as NICs being taken out of a program that had already had many NICs taken out of it. There has been a major change. We need to reassess how we might amend our land use laws and amend 37 so that through those changes we have a program for Oregon's future that works for property owners and works for the community as a whole. It keeps our land use planning framework and keeps fairness. That's something we didn't pursue aggressively enough in 2003.
Bob, one other, since it may be a while before we get you in front of this committee again. This committee spent a lot of time during the interim, many members of it, also traveling around the state of Oregon and conducting hearings. And one of the findings of fact of our committee during the interim was to eliminate third parties from the appeal process. Or do you have an opinion on that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Third parties is a term of art.
That's why I thought you'd be most comfortable with that.
I view it as the folks who go to a hearing before their county commission or their city council or the planning commissions of either body, both an applicant for land use and other people who would be affected by that land use have certain rights to be heard and to get a good and fair decision out of that process. I don't think we should think of people as third parties if they're participants in that local proceeding, if they put their concerns on the record, if they provide fair notice to an applicant, if they are opponents, if you will, if they provide fair notice to an applicant and to the county of what their issues are so that those can be addressed in the local hearing and responded to. If a third party is a sandbagger, somebody who, without ever participating, tries to find a way to attack a decision, that's a different matter. But our land use laws have been changed to force everyone into that local proceeding, to force them to put on the record what their issues are. And the Land Use Board of Appeals, in my judgment, I used to be a land use lawyer, in fact, a long time ago. I'm now, a manager.
So you mature?
Well, perhaps I've outgrown. I've recovered, let's put it that way. The Land Use Board of Appeals is a lot tougher than in my day on sending, refusing to send back to the local government based upon allegations that could have been made more precisely down below. When an appellant tries to stretch the argument a little bit at LUBA, I think we've got a system in terms of the appeals process that is fairly protecting neighbors and applicants for land development because it's focused on the decision-making authority and responsibility of the local officials.
Thank you. Any other committee members have questions? I'm not sure. I'm
still. If I may,
yes.
We specifically talked about neighbors who were affected, and I assume you mean that directly or a little bit indirectly, but basically people that are affected by the decision. I mean, if there's a development 2 miles away and it's going to affect traffic in my neighborhood, I would assume that I'm affected by that and have a right. But I'm not sure that's exactly what we meant in our findings of fact. I mean, I think we meant things like Thousand Friends intervening in a land use decision and helping to carry an appeal. I don't think anybody has a problem with folks who are affected by a land use decision state their claims, notify, and then follow that through. But I think there have been instances, at least we heard about instances, that there were folks intervening and eventually engineering an appeal that weren't directly affected but were representing a larger interest in the process.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Greenman. you can be assured that Phil should be back right here. I can be dropped into any proceeding and start making a record. The important distinction between that I was trying to make is between people who lie in the weeds, whether they live next door or they live across town, and those who participate and make their case in the local proceeding. And I will include certain groups with headquarters in Portland in the category of people who want to have rights to appear. There are two reasons for that. First, our standing laws in land use are based upon participation, not upon showing how badly you were injured by the decision. And that's a determination that was made back in the early 80s, that the important objective is to make sure the local decision-making process is respected and that all the information gets on the record and that people have a chance to argue it at the local level. But the second reason is also embedded in state law. Back in 1981, the Legislative Assembly decided that citizen appeals would be the principal means by which the statewide planning goals would be enforced. That rather than require a city and a county to apply to LCDC for permission to change their plan after acknowledgement, city and counties have the authority to change their plan subject only to appeal. That meant that either LCDC was going to gear up and have a large attorney general budget and supervise a whole set of local comprehensive plan amendments, or that the citizens of that community and their supporters, perhaps including 1,000 Friends of Oregon, will perform some of the function of making sure that state laws, the land use planning goals, were being followed in local decisions. If the state legislative assembly were to decide, well, that is a state function, we'll park that at LCDC, and LCDC has to decide whether or not something violates the laws, that would be a change in policy. The direction that was set 20-plus years ago was that this would be a function that would be largely privatized, that citizens and citizen groups would be responsible through the appeals process for, if you will, blowing the whistle if there were an alleged violation of state law in local land use decisions.
Thank you, sir.
Bob, we appreciate you coming today. You've had some tough questions, and we appreciate your responses. And we appreciate you being here.
Thank you for inviting us to talk as well.
If we could have Ross Day and Glenn, if you want to come away from the coffee and come up with Ross, or you can wait till he's done. It's entirely up to you.
Chair, I'm running out of realtors in the back room. I'm back another shot at answering my question. I was suggesting I could torment Howard more than once in a week.
I think he's giving you a signal. Realtor number one,
presenter. For the record, my name is Grant Stonebrink. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. Thank you for allowing me to testify, Chairman Rod, members of the committee, and excuse me for chewing gum, but I have blood pressure medicine that I take, but if I don't, pretty soon my mouth turns to powder, a desert-like, and I can't talk at all, which might not be a bad thing, depending on the time frame. I'll try not to leave my testimony. I have it in front of you. But I do see that it's always an exciting time for discussion about private property rights, and that's what I consider land use laws to be. If we recall, this was one of the biggest issues that this nation's founders had in setting up the premise for the Revolutionary War. And as I study my history, I find that, when we find all of the things that were wrong, many of them had to do with private property rights. In fact, in the Declaration of Independence, it says, we're endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. And studying Jefferson's works, that there was discussion among others that that pursuit of happiness was supposed to be property, but it didn't sound quite right, and so they finally decided to put a pursuit of happiness. However, then looking at the 5th and 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, they made it very clear that almost exactly the same phrase appears, but now it's a protection of the rights of people to life, liberty, and property. I want to talk just a little bit about when I talk about the 14th or the 15th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution and similar in the Oregon Constitution of compensation. I don't think it's right to think that compensation is the answer when we violate or take away people's private property rights. And by property rights, I'm talking about if without actual taking of title, we do it through regulations. But before any government should take away the value or use of property, they should look at, and they must look at, is there an overwhelming public need? And that's a big phrase to me. Overwhelming means something very large. Has to be explored, and there's just no other way. And then it's for public. It's for the public's need, not want. I think of like a freeway that might go through farmland, and it is determined that the traffic requires that a new freeway be built through farmland for public need. That's okay. But if it's because I like the looks of your farmland, I'd like to drive by and see this farmland, and that's a want. And I think we must make sure we understand the difference. Even as we look at our Founding Fathers' document, the U.S. Constitution, there's an interesting clause in Article 1, Section 8, and it says basically that Congress shall have the power to exercise jurisdiction over all places they purchase, but only with the approval of the state legislature. And when you look at the Federalist Papers about that clause, why it was there was a concern that in the forming of the federal government from the various states, that the federal government would have the power to tax, and of course if they had the power to tax, then they would have the funds in which they could purchase lands within certain states, and as you know, some of those states in the Northeast are the original states, pretty small. It wouldn't take much before the federal government could buy up the entire state and have control. There would be nothing left for the people. And so they addressed it this way, saying that, well, if the federal government wants exclusive jurisdiction over those lands they purchase, then they must get consent from the legislature of that same state. Yes, they can purchase land, but they can't have exclusive jurisdiction or exclusive legislation. And so then they have to go to the state legislature to get that consent. Then, but we see that what is happening today, that our current land use laws are violating the very things that are the U.S. Constitution and the Oregon Constitution, which I've made an attachment. You can see under Article 1 on the back page, which was called the Oregon's Bill of Rights, which was listed first. But there are a number of places there that relate to property, and including Article 1, Section 20, which says that no law shall be passed granting any citizen or class of citizens privileges or immunities which upon the same terms shall not be equal among belong to all citizens. Now, that's interesting, because if you imagine now a farmer with property just barely on the outside of urban growth boundary, and another farmer who's still farming, but his land is now on the inside of urban growth boundary, it seems as though they're being treated not fairly whatsoever. One has certain privileges and one doesn't. And in fact, whether you're a farmer or a non-farmer, the whole land use process violates this provision of law. when you think about it. Because unless someone was to construe to say, well, by protecting this farmland, that and only allowing you, a farmer or a rancher, to do certain things with your land somehow increases your value, is a far stretch, I think. I don't see how that that can be done. I've heard it stated. I think what's most important when we talk about the constitutions and the founding documents is not so much what do they say, but what they don't say. Do we look in there and find something that says, you know, and it is the power of Congress, or it's the power of the state legislature, to make sure that, that certain lands can only be farmed, and if you own that land, you must be a farmer. It doesn't matter whether you're making a profit or not, you still can only farm that land. Does it say that somewhere? Does it say that you can't build a house on the property? Does it say that in our Constitution that we can tell people that they can build a house or a barn? Now, I understand public nuisance laws, and there's some of those things that aren't necessarily written either. But there's some very differences. And in fact, the U.S. Constitution made that clear when they spelled out the people's rights. And then they said in the 9th and 10th Amendment, basically said, if it ain't in that Constitution, government, you can't do it. And then it went clear. Because they didn't want, why did they have to put those in there at all? If it wasn't for the fact that they knew that somehow the nature of government would come along at some point and start to control people. And they didn't want them to do this. I'm not real proud of some of my fellow farmers. I've been a farmer and a rancher. That basically say that, well, and I've heard this testimony in this house, that, well, I farm a piece of ground in the Willamette Valley, and I farm a neighbor's ground, and from time to time they've asked, is there anything else I could do with that land? And I say, basically, no, you can't do anything else. Well, it's not making me much money. Well, it's too bad. What is that? I mean, I hear that. I know these people. I work with them. I agree with them on almost every other issue that we debate. But what they're saying to me is, I want to control my neighbor's land because I get to farm it. I'm not willing to pay the price to buy it. Well, maybe he can't, doesn't want to sell it, but I get to farm it because of our land use laws, and I don't like that. Our land use laws just don't work. If you just drive a little ways towards up our farm and look around the woodland area, you can see some of the highest value farmland in virtually the world, and there's car lots on them. So we continue to build, and urban growth boundaries continue to expand around our cities, which were built in the lowlands, obviously, while we have not taken serious consideration for so-called secondary lands, which would allow for building on the elevated, less productive lands around our cities, and we haven't considered that at all. There is talk now by some of the people that have supported land use laws vigorously in the past that perhaps we should have 5 different regions of the state for land use. And, I think that's fine, but why don't they make 36 regions of the state? In other words, let each county and city make up their own mind about their needs and their counties and their cities by the people who elected them to do so. The Oregon Cattlemen authorized me to again introduce a bill, which I hope makes to this committee. We did it last session and it got nowhere. I understand that, and it probably won't pass. But it basically does just that. It says every city and county shall have a land use plan. But all the rest of the provisions of law of the state will go away. And I looked up that old law before I left, and it's just about an inch thick. That's what it's taken to extract the land use laws and provisions of the state. That's how big it is. The uniqueness of that would be the fact that that the cities and the counties could make up their minds depending upon the needs of their city, of their cities or counties, rather than somebody else from a long distance away who doesn't really know making that for them. And basically, if the Constitution doesn't allow this, then we shouldn't allow it. And remember that everything, when we take private property rights, should always pass the test. Is this an overwhelming public need? I heard earlier about preserving, I'm trying to think of a quote, how much land should we, what land, what kinds of lands need to be protected? I say that property rights need to be protected, which is much more important. And if you have time, Mr. Chairman, but I would be glad to defer for a moment if you would, I would like to relate a personal land use story that kind of boggles the mind, but it's not a cattleman's per se land use story. It's up to you.
Certainly,
can I?
As long as it's clean.
Almost.
A few years ago, my wife and I decided that we have 162 acres in Polk County. It's roughly a rectangle, and we have been leasing out the farmland. The farmland was something like all of this. So what we were told when we went to the county of Connor, they said, why don't you divide off 80 acres and sell out to the farmer? We did that. And we had any surveying done lately, but it's kind of expensive. He said, after you do that, then survey this portion of the farmland and do a lot line adjustment. This was roughly 50 acres. And so we surveyed that off, and we tried to make the sale. The county said it was okay. Didn't say anything wrong. But the state said you can't do that. And why they said you couldn't do that? Because over on this corner, there was 32 acres left. And we have a house on that already. This 80 acres could warrant a house if you can pass the test. This 50 wouldn't make any difference. You couldn't have any additional houses. But they stopped us from selling this 50 acres because we'd be left with 32. That's the
situation. Who in the state, how did the state get into this question?
Pardon me?
You said it was the state that did it.
The state.
How did the state get into this question?
I don't know how they were.
Who in the state?
The state land use.
LCDC?
Yeah.
He came down and said you can't do it?
The state told the county that the county could not do it. I learned of the state's involvement and this denial, and I only had 24 hours to appeal. I came to the state, get the forms, and after I looked at the forms, I went home and I said, well, let's just forget it. And I could get you the documents if you would like, Mr. Chairman, Representative Green. I can get you the documents that show the denial if you want to test that out. I can't get anyone, even the strongest advocates for land use law, to tell me why this is justified. So now we're forced to own this farmland. Well, luckily, we rent this. He still leases this guy about the other part. It's still on the bar. We lease it to him. If he didn't, it happens to be the lesser productive portion of the farm. But if he didn't want to lease it, and we're kind of down at the end of the road, and being less productive, I'm not sure we'd get someone else to farm. So we'd be stuck, no apartment, with a piece of so-called precious EFU land that we wouldn't probably farm because it wouldn't be productive. So it's just an example, and I can say that with all certainty, not a hearsay, because it happened to us. Our land use laws are not proper. And I think they need a lot of work. A lot of our ranchers in eastern Oregon, yes, they do run a lot of federal lands. 52% of our state belongs to the federal government, so it will never be developed. You can't build houses
on that 52%. A lot of the ranch land that goes with it, in order to keep those permits, which, yes, a lot of them are very large, but to keep those permits, they must have a certain amount of base property to run an equal amount of cattle on, so those ranches will not be divided up into small ranchettes if in fact, they plan to keep the federal lands to go with them. So a lot of the concerns about so-called Eastern Oregon development that people might visualize seeing huge developments out in the hinterland are not warranted. And of course, a lot of those haven't been owned for the proper amount of time that measure, whatever that number is, that I can't talk about it, would have any effect on it. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Mr. Stoner? By the way, there's a guy sitting next to you that you might want to talk to. He's found a way to get some of those things changed. Glenn, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Mr. Day, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name's Ross Day. I'm the Director of Legal Affairs at Oregonians in Action. I appreciate the opportunity to address you today about everything but measure, whatever that number was, I can't remember either. I brought my little dog and pony show here for you. This is our primer on Oregon land use. And my desire today is to kind of go over a little bit about what the system is, how it works, discuss some of the commonly held myths about Oregon's land use system and some of the facts that debunk those myths. And then at the end, maybe some suggestions, some areas that it sounded to me like from listening to Mr. Stacy that we might actually agree on, secondary lands and speeding up appeals processes and the like. So with that, I won't go ahead and get started. Oregon's land use system was created in 1973 through the passage of Senate Bill 100. Congressman Bob Smith, who was a state senator at the time, during the campaign for the measure that we shall not talk about, said it is quoted as saying that the land use system bears little resemblance to what they originally passed in 1973. And I'd submit to you that you probably couldn't pass Senate Bill 100 just as it is through this building right now because of the fact that the regulations and restrictions that have developed since then are so restrictive that they would see this as passing Senate Bill 100 as gutting Oregon's land use system, which is something you'll hear a lot this session. One of the fundamental premises of Oregon's land use system, in fact probably the fundamental premise, is it's intended to protect Oregon's natural resource industry, natural resources, primarily ag and forest land, by directing urban uses to urban lands. The primary tool used in land use planning to accomplish that goal is something called an urban growth boundary. And I just picked a town, and this has no significance other than it's a map of the Roseburg area. They draw an urban growth boundary around the city. And land inside the urban growth boundary can be put to urban uses, typically residential uses, commercial, industrial, whereas land outside the urban growth boundary has to be put to primarily natural resource use. So when Senate Bill 100 was passed and the subsequent goals and implementing regulations, you're pretty much restricted to solely natural resource uses outside the urban growth boundaries, farm and forest use, and not much else. And I know all of you are familiar with instances where folks just, you know, like Barbara and Jim Prairie from last session, chief sponsors of that measure we can't talk about, their horses can live on their property, but they can't. That's a result of the overly restrictive nature of the farm and forest zones outside of urban growth boundaries. Senate Bill 100 also was supposed to give local control to counties and cities, but it created the Land Conservation and Development Commission and also the Department, or I should say it spawned the Land Conservation and Development Commission and the Department of Land Conservation and Development. As though you're not familiar with land use planning or land use, it is full of acronyms. UGBs, LCD, DLCD, WUBA, and the list goes on and on. So even though it was supposed to be a locally controlled process, what we actually have is direction from Salem to points near and far here in the state of Oregon. Now, despite the fact that Senate Bill 100 was supposed to be locally controlled and locally implemented, LCDC and DLCD adopted rules in the 70s, which basically forced local governments, like I said earlier, to zone land outside of urban growth boundary, primarily as only forest land or farmland. As a result, state law also requires LCDC to adopt statewide planning goals that local governments' comprehensive plans must therefore comply with. We call that acknowledgement. An acknowledged comp plan or zoning ordinances are ones which have been blessed by DLCD to comply with the lighting planning goals.
Thank you, Dr.
Question.
Yes, please. On that issue, it seems to me we heard a lot of testimony in the interim on land that was outside of the urban growth boundary but was zoned industrial commercial. It was a question of how large can you build.
I am aware in limited circumstances, and I think Umatilla County, Klamath County, none of them come to mind, but I'm sure there are, where there are limited circumstances where you'll have rural industrial or rural commercial land. Interestingly enough, on that point.
And rural residential.
And rural residential. You've got, in limited circumstances, areas that have been developed to the point where rural residential is pretty much the only use that can go on out there. But the overwhelming majority of land outside the urban growth boundary is zoned farm, forest, or open space.
Thank you.
Of the 19 statewide planning goals, you're probably going to hear, this community is probably going to really hear about three of them. Goal 3, which is the agricultural lands goal. Goal 4, which is the forest lands goal. And goal 5, which is the natural resource, scenic, and historic uses goal, I believe. And that's primarily where the overwhelming amount of frustration with our land use system stems from are those three goals. Goal 3 is, like I said, is the agricultural lands goal, and it states that agricultural land shall be preserved and maintained for farm use consistent with existing and future needs for agricultural products, forest, and open space. I didn't know open space was a agricultural use, but apparently it is. And with the state's agricultural land use policy expressed in the law. Now, I will tell you as well, there's only one other place in Oregon law, in statute, which discusses open space as an agricultural use, and it's basically an afterthought in 215.243. Other than that, open space, the requirement for open space is pretty much in force created with the Department of Land Conservation Development. This is some prime farmland out in Cook County. Doesn't that look right? You can see lush green fields out there. This land is a client of mine, June Gramzow. We did a forage report to determine how much vegetation was on the property and what you could actually sustain. June Gramzow had 320 acres and wanted to subdivide off his 320 acres to 10-acre non-farm parcels on this property, scab land. Couldn't grow rocks on it. The forage report said with 19 days you could graze one calf, and then that's it. Appellants, including Thousand Friends of Oregon, argued that, well, you didn't, sure, you could graze one calf for 19 days, but you never discussed about llamas or ewes or other grazing animals. So you need to go back and demonstrate that. They also said that you could store salt licks and store hay on here, and that's an agricultural use. Well, if that's the case, then every square inch in Oregon could be farmland, prime farmland, for that matter. This was after 2 years, and I bet you it was about $40,000 if I had charged him. We finally got permission to put 2 10-acre non-farm parcels right there. Keep in mind, there are still 300 acres of land that was being used that looks not dissimilar from this for ranching as well. 2 years and thousands of dollars for this type of land. We're protecting this type of land. This is Bob Harris's property up in Jefferson County, and it looks exactly the same as Gene Granzell's property, again, out in Eastern Oregon, prime farmland. And of course, you have Gulf Oil, which is the Forest Lands Grill. Again, I won't read the whole thing, but basically, it's the Forest Lands Grill is intended to protect Oregon's forest and make it economically efficient to ensure continuous growing and harvesting of forest tree species. Of course, other laws have pretty much torpedoed that industry. But this is Frank and Sandra Hardin's property out in Jackson County, prime forest land. The land you see in the foreground, in the background, is not their property. This is the land in the foreground. This is actually should be an aggregate bid. In fact, ODOT says it's one of the potentially most productive, best aggregate sites in the state of Oregon. Currently, ODOT has to truck when they need aggregate. You have to truck it up from Roseburg. This is just outside of the city of Jacksonville, and if you're familiar with Medford, you know that they're doing quite a bit of road work down there. It seemed to be a lot more efficient and cost savings for the state if they would actually use this land. You might be wondering, well, why is it forest land? There's no trees there. Well, directly about 10 feet underneath the dirt is a giant cavern. This was an old gold mine, and there is no dirt underneath there for trees to grow. That's why you have only these small scrubs there. But again, this is forest land. They can't do anything with it because of the really restrictive designation. These two Goal 3 and Goal 4 on the picture I've shown you are examples, albeit anecdotal, of the problems that are facing our land use system, are created, I should say, by our land use system. Goal 5 is the Natural Resources, Scenic, and Historic Areas and Open Spaces Goal. And again, here we see what Goal 5 is intended to do, primarily to, impose open spaces in urban areas. Here's an example of what Goal 5 is, the kind of impacts it will have, and I'm sure you'll hear a lot about this. Metro, in August, I think it was, of 2004, decided they were going to try to impose a Goal 5 overlay, which was going to significantly limit what even a residential property, what they could and couldn't do with their property. This was from, this is a press release from December 10th, after obviously that measure passed. And now you see at the bottom, what they're planning on doing is incentive-based voluntary programs to achieve Goal 5. It was something they could have done prior to the passage of the measure, but it was only after they had a stick, and they were beaten over the head with a stick, that they decided, oh, well, we can actually work with property owners as opposed to against them. It's these kind of things that people, why Measure 37 passed. They see these kinds of things and they say, well, why couldn't you do this before November 2nd? Simple. The government didn't have to. It wasn't until Measure 37 passed that suddenly the government had an epiphany and they decided, hey, guess what? We can actually work with property owners and maybe actually get what we want and more so. And if you ask the Council President Bragdon, he'll tell you we're actually getting more than they would have gotten with the overlay zones they proposed prior to the passage of Measure 37. Goal 5, and I would submit to you as well today that Goal 5 is a prime example of why the land use system needs fixing. If we go back to the original premise that Oregon's land use laws are supposed to protect natural resource lands by directing urban uses to urban lands, I ask you this question. How then is it consistent with Oregon's land use laws, which are supposed to keep compatible uses next to each other, how is it consistent with Oregon's land use laws that we start putting natural resource uses on urban lands? That doesn't make any sense. That seems to run directly counter to what Oregon's land use laws are originally supposed to do. And I would submit to you that when I spoke earlier about Senate Bill 100, this is an example of how Senate Bill 100 is no longer about planning, but it's about controlling the way and where people live. This is a prime example of it. We want to see pretty green open spaces, not only outside the urban growth boundary, but inside as well, despite the fact that that concept conflicts with the intended purpose behind Oregon land use laws. I want to talk about the six biggest myths about Oregon's land use planning system. I know you will hear from witnesses in the near future that Oregon's land use planning system is a nationally acclaimed model. I love it. They created this program, and then they gave themselves an award for creating the program. But here's a fact. In the 32 years since Senate Bill 100 passed, no other state in the union has anything like Oregon's land use planning system. Measure 37, I get a lot of calls from other states about it and say, well, can we get this here in our state? And I say, well, you could try, but you don't have a system like what we have here, and so it'll be a lot more difficult for you. Logically, I would suspect if this was a nationally acclaimed model that was so great that all other 49 states in the union, or at least a majority of them, would have adopted it sometime within the last 32 years, but the fact of the matter is they have not. Washington, I would submit, however, is working towards that, although they haven't quite gotten there yet. Without Oregon's land use planning system, Oregon would be one big subdivision. That's my favorite. In fact, that was what they were saying about our ballot measure as well. This is what we call the Pepsi flowchart, for obvious reasons, because it looks like a Pepsi symbol. 57% of land in the state is owned by the federal government, 3% is owned by state and local governments, and 38% is currently under fire and forest land protection. That means 2% of the land that can be developed. Imagine if we doubled that to 4%. You'd still have 96% of the land in this state off limits to development. That chart there, I think, pretty much sums it up. If you just doubled the amount of land that could be developed, you'd still have 96% of the land that couldn't be developed, urbanized, if you will, term of art, in the land use system. The Oregon land use system preserves livability. Fact, and I think you heard Mr. Stacy dance around this a little bit, but since the inception of Oregon's land use planning system, the Portland metropolitan area has gone from one of the most affordable to one of the least affordable areas to live. This is from the National Association of Home Builders. Most economists agree with the bulk of the economic literature that growth policies increase land prices. And again, one thing I will talk about livability quickly. It's a wonderful term of art that the pro-planning community uses. You won't find it defined anywhere in Oregon law. It's one of those amorphous moving targets that you can constantly and consistently redefine. But I'm presuming one of the measuring sticks for livability is traffic congestion, and under Metro's 2040 growth plan, rush hour traffic congestion will significantly increase as a result of Oregon's land use planning system. Oregon's land use system is good for the economy. This, I think, sums it up pretty well. 120 days in Oregon is considered fast track. You'll remember there was a Yamhill County had an opportunity about 6 or 8 years ago to get a chip manufacturing plant. And they were told that it was going to take a minimum of 120 days to get their building permits. They ended up moving to Phoenix, Arizona, where they were told they'd get their building permits in 15 days. Gee, I wonder why they moved there. It makes perfect sense. If businesses can't reliably, on the land that they need, the workforce need, and permits and utilities at a competitive price, we won't make the list from PDC. And this was a quote from the Oregonian, obviously, last year regarding the biorefinery plant out in Eastern Oregon. Oregon's land use planning system is popular with Oregonians. Well, if Measure 37's result doesn't debunk that myth, here's some more that I alluded to on Monday. We asked Oregonians how would you rate Oregon's land use system. You'll see 58% said only fair or poor. I don't know that it's that necessarily constitutes popularity with Oregon's land use system. We then asked them, do you have any experience in dealing with Oregon's land use planning system? Of the people we asked, 52% said no, 48% said yes. We asked that 48% then, how would you rate your experience with Oregon's land use planning system? 5% said excellent, 52% said poor, total 77% said fair to poor. So this notion that Oregon's land use planning system is somehow popular with Oregonians, I don't think is, in fact, the case. Oregon's land use system benefits the public at no cost to anyone. In fact, you heard earlier the second paycheck effect. I would submit to you that if people are getting a second paycheck, that must mean that somebody's paying for that paycheck. Who is it that's paying for the paycheck? It's Oregon's property owners. This gentleman is Sam Mahaney. He's a cab driver in Portland. Moved here from Iran right before the Shah fell. He bought this property here out in western Washington County. This is wetlands. It's farmland wetlands. Can't build anything on it. The rules changed on him after he purchased the property. He sunk all of his life savings into this property. Doesn't look like there's very much standing water. In fact, it looks like your average everyday field. But because of Goal 3 and Goal 5, Sam is unable to deal with his property as he otherwise would have been when he originally purchased the property. Now, unless you think that we cherry-picked and we took this picture of the driest month of the year, this was taken in late January of 2001, I believe. And, of course, we all know Dorothy English. And the fact that she's had everything taken from her. The opponents, those folks who last session said that the Dorothy English bill is going to gut Oregon's land use planning system, will tell you, well, she's already made $75,000 off of her land when she sold it back in 1970. That still doesn't dismiss the fact that she's lost everything. Hopefully now, being the first Measure 37 claimant, hopefully she'll be able to get her rights back. Last year, there was an effort prior to the installation of the new Salem City Council to start a Goal 5 overlay in Salem. I had a client whose property was on a hillside that was going to be designated as wetland, even though there was no water source anywhere near a property. But just because the land use planners thought it was wetland, they didn't bother to go out there and take a look at it. The onus was going to be on her to prove them wrong. Fortunately, the city of Salem has had a revelation. They've decided to scrap that project. Wilsonville filed suit against the Ministry for Unpaid Taxes. This is just one of the most ironic situations I've heard. The city of this church owned some property in Wilsonville, and they were holding on to it with the expectation that they'd sell some of it and use that money to build a new church, which the mayor of Wilsonville was a member of. The city subsequently downzoned their property to a point that they can't sell it for anything, and then at the same time, the city of Wilsonville foreclosed because the church was unable to pay all of its property taxes, and as a result, they ended up losing all of their property. And much to the surprise of the mayor of Wilsonville, who advocated for those downzoning, only to find out it was hurting the church. Of course, when Measure 7 passed, the opponents of Measure 7 said that it was going to cost $5.4 billion a year to compensate property owners in the state of Oregon, and which we quickly fired back, and I think accurately so, that $5.4 billion reflects exactly what the cost Oregon's land use planning system has on Oregonians. Issues that the legislature should address, that we would certainly encourage you to address. First is the definition of farm and forest land under Goal 3 and 4. At the very least, we think that the committee and the legislature should maybe ask DLCD to review and revisit those definitions and maybe loosen them up as Senator McPherson discussed on Monday.
Ross, just a moment to the committee members. I've been instructed by administrator to make sure that each committee member has a complete list of all goals and their definitions. So our committee members will have those.
Speaking of the land use process, one of the findings of fact that the committee found was these third party appeals, and we'd certainly support taking a look at that issue as well. Development on resource-owned lands. One of the problems that we're going to have, and I think one of the come-to-Jesus that we're going to have is, as policymakers, I suppose, is the fact that any revision to Oregon's land use laws is going to result in development on resource lands. That's just the way it is. We've been ratcheted down to the point that we have no other option but to go up. We can't go much further down unless we were to just declare everything open space. So you're going to hear, if you have anything like we did last session, we had a bill that would have extended a lot of record laws. That was going to gut Oregon's land use planning system. We had a bill that was going to allow development on land that didn't fall within the definition of Goal 3 or 4 land. And that was going to gut Oregon's land use planning system because it was going to allow development in rural zones. Well, I'm here to suggest to you, and I think everybody needs to come to this realization, that any real reforms with teeth in them that we propose and that you guys consider is going to result in development on resource lands, and you're going to be told that it's going to gut Oregon's land use system. And I'm saying that up front so that you can start getting the stomach bit, because that's what you're going to hear. And fourth, return local control to local governments. The fact of the matter is, you heard Mr. Stonebrink discuss his personal situation. You look at the city of Kaiser up north. It was only after some pressure put on DLCD that they didn't try to hold up the city of Kaiser's economic development plan up there as well. I'd submit that I think we really do need to return local control to local governments. I can't overemphasize this point. The committee needs to understand that any reforms, virtually any reforms to Oregon's land use system is going to result in more development. But increased development does not mean gutting Oregon's land use system. I want to make that perfectly clear. Oregonians in Action is oftentimes accused of being anti-land use, anti-planning. That couldn't be farther from the truth. I myself was appointed to statewide land use planning agency by Governor Kitzhaber. I served on my city's planning commission. I think planning is good government, but we don't plan for development anymore. What we do, we don't determine where people live, but now our land use planning system determines how people live. I just want to end with what you heard Senator McPherson say on Monday. I think we have to do something regardless of what happens to Measure 37. The people, 61%, say we have to do something serious about land use planning. And what I found when I was out on the campaign trail was that people said we haven't gotten any satisfaction, any loosening up. We need to look at those kinds of things, and we need to make it a whole lot fairer to everybody if we went in that direction. I could not agree with Senator McPherson more. And I hope that the committee certainly not only takes to heart the words of myself and Mr. Stonebrink, but certainly Senator McPherson as well. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of Mr. Day?
Mr. Chairman, can I be granted 60 additional seconds?
For a slight additional charge.
There was one handout on what I gave you that talks about the Administrative Procedures Act. And very quickly, it says in rulemaking by any agency, and I'm, of course, focusing this on LCDC, but if the economic effect analysis shows that the rule has significant adverse effect upon small business to the extent consistent with the public health and safety program, the rule of the rule, the agency shall reduce the economic impact of the rule on small businesses by, and there are five things you can do. Now, it doesn't say you may or you should, it says you shall. And obviously, when these rules were passed, like the $80,000 rule and some of the others, and in fact, the whole land use plan to start with, there was a significant economic adverse effect upon landowners. And what's interesting, when you look at all five of these options, there's really only one that makes any sense, and that's number four, and that says exempting small business from any or all requirements of the rule. And guess what is described as small businesses under the law are farmers and ranchers. So, I mean, you have something that's virtually cancels itself out. And then one final request, if I may, that I think would be helpful, is if you as a committee could request, and maybe you've already done this, of LCDC, to make a list for the public, a public list of all of the key legislation and rules that have taken place over the years, and the implementation date of the state. Now, I know this won't be the same implementation date for all the counties, but it would be good to know the history of what all of these things go on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ross, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The committee appreciates the education process, and your coming down today really does helps to better understand what we're dealing with. So we appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
And committee, there will be down the line an opportunity when this committee will get into Measure 37. I can assure you of that. But in the meantime, we will also need to be made aware that there are other land use questions that we can address and we intend to address outside of Measure 37. So we'll do our best at doing it all. We do have only two, Patty. I know your Natural Resources Committee has, 15 bills already? This committee has two. We put those on the Monday agenda to address. Shouldn't take us very long. And that's all we have at this point. So we will not have a meeting on Friday. At this point, I'm quite sure as we steam along during the session, we'll have plenty to do. So we might as well take the opportunity to have a day off when we can. Committee, thank you very much, and we'll see you Monday at 1:30. Land Committee is adjourned.